50 years ago, it was the Summer of Love, and a famous three-day festival took place, the Monterey Pop Festival, June 16th through June 18th. So the same month, Monterey County Fairgrounds is where it happened. It started the career of several artists, put them on a world stage. It stayed with us as a huge, iconic music festival. It's part of history. We are joined by Scott Goldman, an expert in all of this, executive director from the Grammy Museum at LA Live.
Hey, Tina.
Hi, and congratulations, executive director.
Thank you. It still sounds a little weird, but I'm happy to have it.
You're perfect for the part. I mean, you're doing such a good job between all of the question and answer sessions that you have, which are incredible.
Yeah, luckiest man in America.
Yes, yeah. And you're co-curating right now, Marty Stewart.
Yeah, this is the first time that the Grammy Museum has done a deep dive into country music.
Yeah.
And we couldn't think of anyone better to do it with than Marty Stewart, who... Mm-hmm. Arguably, outside the Country Music Hall of Fame, he himself has perhaps the largest, most extensive collection of country music memorabilia of anybody in the world. It's incredible what he's got, and much of it you can see at the Grammy Museum right now.
Yes, and so it gives you an idea also of how much you cover, how many different genres, and how you keep music history there for us, current and past.
That's exactly mm-hmm. right. I mean, we're fortunate. We're the Grammys. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame mm-hmm. or the Country Music Hall of Fame, you know, they need to kind of stay in their lanes. We can go anywhere, rock, pop, classical, jazz, and we do. We pursue all genres of music. Our museum is about all genres of music. You can learn an awful lot about all genres of music by visiting us at the Grammy Museum. So we're very happy to play on a very wide field.
Yes, and the field right now includes the Monterey International Pop Festival, Music, Love, and Flowers. This exhibit shows us 1967, and
yes.
The big players, there were many big players, actually, including the Jimi Hendrix Experience and The Who, Janis Joplin with Big Brother and The Holding Company. And then also, it was created by John Phillips, right?
Correct.
With Lou Adler.
Yes, Lou mm-hmm. Adler. He was John Phillips and Lou Adler were the co-founders of the Monterey International Pop Festival. They had a lot of support and encouragement from a gentleman named Alan Pariser, who helped them envision a multi-day, multi-artist, multi-genre festival.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really John and Lou that got it done.
And Lou was at a recent question and answer.
Oh, yes. When we opened the exhibit about a mm-hmm. month ago or so, we had Lou in for an evening public program. And, you know, he's somebody who I don't think necessarily gets the recognition he deserves for the remarkable diversity in his career. You know, most people who become successful in music, they become successful as a producer,
mm-hmm.
or they become successful as a record executive, or they become successful as a concert promoter, or they become successful as a songwriter. Well, guess what? He's done all of those things. It's just remarkable the level of success he's had in so many different career paths in music.
Right. He's like an entertainment giant.
Exactly. Exactly.
He must have had all types of questions coming at him.
He did. I mean, the Q&A ranges all over the place. I mean, as many people want to talk to him about Carole King's Tapestry,
yeah.
an album he produced, as they do the Monterey Pop Festival.
Right. He produced the Mamas and the Papas.
Oh, mm-hmm. he produced a couple of their albums, mm-hmm. and he managed the Mamas and Papas.
Which is how John Phillips and Lou Adler ended up planning
exactly right.
the Monterey Pop Festival. And
exactly
do you want right. to, you have items, you know, artifacts from some of the artists that were there. Do you want to talk about
yeah.
some of the big artists that were there?
Sure. Well, you know, first and foremost, Monterey Pop was an incredibly eclectic and diverse lineup across 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the amazing things to remember about Monterey Pop is when Lou and John envisioned it, they very quickly realized that they wanted to make it about something more than just presenting great music. That
mm-hmm.
was the intention. However, what isn't as well known is there was a foundation formed very early on to make Monterey Pop a benefit concert,
mm-hmm.
Not something that was really commonly done at that point, and really set the template for bigger fundraising benefits that happened down the road. But none of the artists, with the exception of one, that appeared at Monterey Pop got paid because this was a benefit. And Lou contends that because of that, he did not have a problem with any artist about where they appeared on the bill, what their set length was. There was no ego involved because it was a benefit for charitable purposes.
Right.
So that's a remarkable little factoid that I think sometimes gets overlooked. But this was the breakout performance for Jimi Hendrix. It was the breakout performance for Janis Joplin. This was the first chance for a national audience to really see and hear Jimi Hendrix in all his glory. When you look at the Monterey Pop film that D.A. Pennybaker made, one of the most remarkable things that Pennybaker did was, in addition to capturing the performance footage in a way that was very unusual and very unique, he captured a lot of audience reaction. And in that moment where Hendrix is setting his guitar on fire, that iconic moment, there are shots of people in the crowd who are literally covering their mouths because they cannot believe, you know, what they're seeing, the impact of that performance. But there were so many. This was the first time people really got to hear Janis Joplin, the first time that people had, outside the Bay Area, had gotten the chance to hear the Grateful Dead. This was The Who. I think this was their second major performance in the U.S.
Yes.
At that point.
Janis Joplin was there with Big Brother and the Holding Company. She was billed with them rather than her name being out front.
Exactly right. She was still just she was the singer with the band.
Yeah. And then after that, things started to change.
Yes. Yeah. And for all of these artists, and arguably for rock music, you know, one of the intentions that Lou and John originally had. Lou tells the story of a conversation that was had at Cass Elliott's house. And Lou was there and Cass Elliott was there and John Phillips was there and Paul McCartney was there. And they were talking about rock music and rock music's place in culture and how, to that point, rock did not occupy the same place in our culture as jazz or folk music or classical music. And they wanted to create something. They wanted to figure out a way to elevate rock music in, you know, the cultural consideration in this country.
Right.
And ultimately what they came to was Monterey Pop.
Yeah, there was the Monterey Jazz Festival that had preceded this.
Exactly.
And they went, let's make rock legitimate, just like the Jazz Festival.
Right, And there was the Newport Folk Festival, you know, also well-known. You know, there were many large-scale music festivals built around jazz music, built around folk music, but not rock music to that point.
And there was even sitar included. So there was different kinds of rock music, folk rock music, psychedelic rock.
Yes.
And then you had some, it was Ravi, right?
Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. The interesting fact about Ravi Shankar is he's the only guy who got paid.
Yeah, right. He got paid
the
somehow.
The only guy who got paid because the dates at the Monterey Fairgrounds were originally held by a promoter and manager named Ben Shapiro. And Benny Shapiro managed Ravi Shankar. So he had already contracted Ravi Shankar to appear at Monterey. At that point, it wasn't even called the Monterey Pop Festival. But he had contracted him to appear, and contract's a contract, so Robbie got paid.
So he's the one that got paid.
Yeah.
And the ticket prices would be like $22 to $47 today, I believe. They were $3 to $6.50.
Yeah, it was like $3.50, $4.50, $5.50, and $6.50.
Yeah.
Some silly number. The amazing thing about Monterey Pop and you know, if you will, the finances of the festival is they ultimately made their money from selling, you know, the rights to the film, from recordings that came out of the festival. And that foundation that was established 50 years ago is still making contributions to worthy charities today. In fact, I was with Lou Adler in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. We did another program up there because the whole city of San Francisco is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. And Lou brought with him a check for the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic for $10,000 from the Monterey Pop Foundation. And at our program, I want to say the guy's name is Dennis Smith, who founded the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, stood up from the audience during the Q&A and gave the most impassioned testimonial about how important the original $25,000 funding from Monterey was back in 1967. Now, think about that. $25,000 in 1967 went an awful long way.
It did, right.
And here we are 50 years later, and that foundation is still making gifts to charities. I think it's a remarkable testament to what Lou Adler built.
It really is. And Bob Santelli was the founding director of the Grammy Museum, right?
Yes.
He wrote Aquarius Rising, the Rock Festival Years. So do you think that this also laid the groundwork for like Live Aid? You know, when you're talking about...
No question. Uh-huh. No, whether it's the concert for Bangladesh, mm-hmm. Whether it's Live Aid, whether it's any innumerable number of music benefits that have happened since Monterey, there is no question that this laid, you know, basically built the template.
Even Coachella, we had that, and Woodstock came after
right,
the Monterey
right.
Pop
Although
Festival.
Although Lou famously has said, Monterey Pop was about the music. Mm-hmm. Woodstock was about the weather.
Did he bring that up in his Q&A?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Of course.
Yeah, that's a famous quote of his.
That's great.
He likes to say that.
There were so many artists. It's hard to go through them all. There were 32, including Otis Redding, who really got famous after that.
That was truly Otis's breakout performance. That is where, you know, he became known on the national stage. And if you ask Lou, of all the moments that he remembers from that weekend, which one musically stands out for him, it's Otis.
He was there along with Jefferson Airplane, along with the Buffalo Springfield, and David Crosby joined them.
Yeah, we mentioned Ravi Shankar, but there were other artists like Hugh Masekela, the great South African trumpet player. Mm-hmm. The breadth and diversity of the artists that were presented, you know, people forget Lou Rawls.
Mm-hmm. Right, Lou Rawls was there, yeah.
Johnny Rivers played. Johnny Rivers, by the way, played, and the guy playing piano in Johnny Rivers' band was Jimmy Webb. You know, it's one of these sort of moments in history where when you really start to kind of peel the onion back a little bit, you go, wow.
Look at all the layers that happened after
incredible.
This. Exactly, yeah. It was just an incredible moment in time. A big... Yeah. Big, huge world type of party in one place.
Right. You know? So if you come to the Grammy Museum, you'll see, you know, you'll see some cool outfits. You'll see Ravi Shankar's outfit. You'll see a reproduction of the guitar that Hendrix burned and destroyed. You'll see all kinds of really cool paperwork, contracts, and letters that were sent to artists imploring them to participate, explaining that nobody's getting paid, that this is a benefit. You know, because all of these things, you know, this was not in the cultural DNA at that point. It all had to be explained. So there's all this interesting paperwork and letters that Lou had to write to people to get them to participate.
Right. So you can see what was going on. Between the back and forth and what it took for him to get this off the ground, to get this to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is all on the third floor.
On the third floor at the Grammy Museum.
That is a phenomenal exhibit. You have many of them, including the one that you co-curated, the Marty Stewart exhibit. We're looking at, you know, country from the perspective of Southern California.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Looking at country music through the lens of the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was extraordinarily privileged to work with Marty Stewart, who I believe is a treasure in American music. This is someone who has such a deep reverence for those who have come before him in country music, and has basically made out the rest of his life to honor the tradition from which he comes, and also in his own way push country music forward. So we're looking at country music through Marty's remarkable collection and the lens of the West. Mm-hmm. So, you know, beginning with a group that does not often get the due, I think, that they deserve, and that's the Maddox Brothers and Rose. Mm-hmm. You know, these were four brothers and a sister who, you know, played, for lack of a better term, hillbilly boogie. Mm-hmm. You know, what they did was, you know, they took acoustic guitars, revved up the speed at which they played songs. They were very funny. They wore outrageous Nathan Turk costumes, you know, with outrageous embroidery, crazy boots. And you got to remember, this is the 1940s. I mean, people had not seen energy like this on stage. And many people say that, you know, the Maddox Brothers and Rose, not only do they belong in the Country Music Hall of Fame, they belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because they were really on the leading edge of what ultimately came to be known as rockabilly. Yeah. And they were heard because they got connected to a border radio station, XERB. They were heard literally throughout the western United States.
So they had a huge, massive territory with the following. And Marty Stewart has a huge private collection.
He does.
And Johnny Cash is also included.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, Johnny Cash had, you know, not only was he telling stories mm-hmm. in the way, in a manner that we would come to associate with, you know, kind of country and western mm-hmm. music, but he made arguably two of his most important records in California, at Folsom Prison and at San Quentin Prison.
That's right.
You know, at Folsom Prison, I believe is, you know, his, to this day, his still his best selling record. Mm-hmm. So California had a particular influence on the way Cash looked at interacting with audiences, on the way he felt it was important for him to reach people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a great guitar of his. We've got one of his, you know, black coats. We've got very cool stuff to
see. In black.
The Man in Black.
Must have a black coat there of his, right? And you have the lyrics to Folsom Prison?
Yes, we do. Handwritten by Johnny Cash. Yep.
Folsom
Indeed.
Prison Blues. Oh, okay,
Indeed.
Cool. And who else is involved in this exhibit? Buck Owens?
Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. Uh-huh. You know, obviously the Bakersfield sound, very important to the history of country music. You know, these guys, both of them, you know, took country music. They pushed the drums into the front of the mix. Mm-hmm. They strapped on Fender Telecaster guitars. The guitars were stinging. The steel guitar was twangier than it's mm-hmm. ever been. And they truly made, you know, country music something that could move people in a honky tonk and get people, you know, could rise above the din in a honky tonk. And on top of that, Haggard in particular was a songwriter literally without compare. And he spoke in a way that common people mm-hmm. could understand. He spoke of, you know, troubles and tough times and losing love and being comforted by alcohol, mm-hmm. You know, tough times at work, you know, the things that working people, you know, inherently understood.
Right, which is many people. He pulled out those emotions in all
yes.
of us. That's common ground for many people. So
yes.
that exhibit is going on until
The middle of September.
Okay, so that
yep.
went there.
So
the
so plenty of
September.
Time, but come and check it out. It's super cool.
Marty Stewart's Way Out West.
Yep, a country music odyssey.
Mm-hmm. And then is there also an exhibit with X, a punk exhibit going
well,
on?
Yes, we're coming to mm-hmm. opening an exhibit celebrating the 40th anniversary of X and punk music mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. We're looking forward to that. Some of the dates may be a little bit in flux because we're changing some things around on our curatorial calendar, but that will be opening at some point in 2017, I can assure you.
Yeah, that is a fascinating story of X and how
yeah.
they were at the forefront of punk, you
yes.
know, and how they met. And then you also have Sheryl Crow coming.
Yeah, well, we've got, so our public program mm-hmm. series, which you've mentioned, you know, truly one of the unique things about the Grammy Museum as a cultural institution is most museums, they start with the curatorial. Everything flows from that. Public programs, education, everything flows from curatorial. Well, our founding executive director, Bob Santelli, had a genius idea, and that is to make public programs the equal of curatorial in terms of the importance of the mission of the museum. So we set out very early on to make these public programs important, to give artists the space to tell their stories in a way that you don't often hear. As we like to say, we break down the barrier between the artist and the audience, and mm-hmm. we do this about 100 times a year, which is kind of remarkable. And just in the next 2 weeks, we have coming up June 7th is Sheryl Crow, June 9th, Taj Mahal and Keb Mo. June 13th, Dan Auerbach, who's got a terrific solo record coming out from the Black Keys, will be with us. And on June 14th, Justin Hayward, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the landmark Moody Blues record, Days of Future Past,
yes,
will be with us. And that's just the next 2 weeks.
And are they speaking? Are they playing?
They will speak. We'll mm-hmm. do an interview, and then they will all perform.
Mm, yeah.
And
really
by the way, it's
amazing.
It's the best entertainment value in Los Angeles because none of our tickets are more than $35.
Yes. And it's an intimate setting, too.
Yeah. 200-seat theater.
Right. And so we can find out about all of this at GrammyMuseum.org. GrammyMuseum.org. And mm-hmm. you have now combined with your sister foundation, the Grammy Foundation. And
right.
the Grammy Museum or what?
Yes. Yeah. It took us a little while, but we kind of figured out that it was important for both missions, the mission of the Grammy Foundation, which was originally concerned with music education, archiving, and preservation, and the mission of the museum, to be one thing rather than two. Mm-hmm. And officially, as of April 17th, we finally got that together, and we are now one thing, the Grammy Museum.
Mm-hmm. The Grammy Museum at LA Live, open 7 days
a week? 7 days a week.
7 days a week on Olympic.
Yep.
And you can see all of the incredible exhibits that we were just talking about.
Come mm-hmm. and see us.
Yeah. And the definitely the Monterey International Pop Festival, Music, Love, and Flowers.
Yes.
That song, San Francisco.
Wear some flowers in your hair.
Yes. That ran before the festival to promote it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that song written by John Phillips, mm-hmm. originally intended for, I think it was originally intended for the Mamas and Papas. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, Scott McKenzie, who was a friend of John Phillips, I guess John decided that he liked the way Scott sang the song, gave it to him, and it turned out to be a big hit.
Yes, it did. And remembered as part of the festival.
Yes. You know, with the festival. No question. And inextricably linked with the mm-hmm. Summer of Love.
Right. Yeah. Summer of Love at the Grammy Museum, LA Live. Thank you, Scott.
Oh, thank you.
Scott Goldman, executive director, overseeing all and doing an amazing job.
Thank you.
Thank you for protecting music history, for all of the education, for the foundation, and for the Monterey International Pop Festival, Music, Love, and Flowers exhibit at the Grammy Museum at LA Live.